Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. I'm waiting to hear from my guest, but I have lots to talk about with you, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to spend a little time doing that. I've been communicating a lot with Great Britain, as many of you know who've been listening to the show, and among other debates going on there now is the issue of shock treatment. Folks don't realize it, but electroshock treatment is still being used all over the world, including the United States, Canada, and Great Britain. Most cities in the U.S. have multiple access points for shock treatment, general hospital wards, private psychiatric hospitals, pretty much everywhere except not much in the state mental hospitals. Now, the reason why shock is being used in so many different places is that it's very remunerative. It pays well. Shock facilities will keep a psychiatric ward in profit. That's how important it is. So how does shock treatment work? Well, it's not very complicated. You're passing strong electrical currents through, usually nowadays, both sides of the brain, still do bilateral ECT. And that means that both currents are going right through the frontal lobes as well as spreading throughout the brain. But even if you do the unilateral one side of the brain, you're still hitting the frontal lobes very hard. So you're producing an what we used to call an organic brain syndrome. It's a traumatic brain injury. Person wakes up after a coma, produces a coma, this supposedly harmless treatment. Person wakes up disoriented, not remembering what's happened to them, confused. In other words, just like a traumatic brain injury patient after a car crash. Then, as in any trauma to the brain, the person gradually recovers over time, but similar to other traumatic brain injuries, the individual does not usually recall the event itself. And with time, more and more, and repeated traumatic brain injuries, more and more memory is lost. Then other facilities are lost, such as the ability to learn well, to learn new things, to multitask, all the symptoms that you'd expect from exposure again and again and again, 6, 8, 10, 20 times to traumatic brain injury. The effects are very lobotomy-like because of the damage to the front lobe, and that's how the treatment works. The so-called treatment is simply closed-head injury with lobotomy-like effects.
Hello, Peter.
Yes, hi, Tom. I know you're there, and this is Tom Moore. I'm so glad you're there, and I'll be with you in a second. I'll be with you in a second. Tom, I'm working here on a instant messaging with my engineer, so I knew you had arrived, and I should have let you know that. I wanted to tell the folks one other thing that's come across my desk, and that is, by the way, folks, if you're interested in ECT, if you know anybody who might get ECT, please, please go to ectresources.org, ectresources.org. I spent hundreds of hours setting that up, providing everything from colored brochures to more than 100 scientific PDFs just to give people scientific information and easy access to information about ECT. The other thing that's crossed my desk is that this month's clinical psychiatry news, and the headline is Antipsychotics Risk in Dementia Revised Upward. So all of these elderly ladies with dementia that we're giving antipsychotics to in the nursing homes are having their lives crushed and shortened. But folks, I mean, the information is always going to be worse and worse in psychiatry because the people who produce the information are hiding from the facts. My guest, Tom Moore, is a source of facts about psychiatry, an incredible source of facts about psychiatry. And we're going to provide you all kinds of new information about violence and drugs, children and drugs, their adverse effects. Tom has his own institute. I'll let you let him start out maybe by telling you about his institute, his newsletter, how you can get in touch with him. And then we'll launch into a discussion, I think, of drugs and violence. Tom, hello.
Hello, Peter. It's a pleasure to be with you. So let me do give you some background. It's definitely not my institute, although I'm really pleased to be associated. I'm a senior scientist for the Institute for Safe Medication Practices, and it's a fairly substantial size nonprofit with about 35 or 40 people, most of them in Philadelphia.
Tom, I didn't know this. This is great. Go ahead, tell me more.
And it is a nonprofit who is exclusively devoted to education and research on safer medication use. And among the other things that ISMP does is we have a group of four or five newsletters. The sort of flagship goes to every acute care hospital in the country, particularly to the pharmacy department, and is filled with information about what can go wrong and how to make it not go wrong. I'm project director for a quarterly publication called Quarter Watch, and we are a kind of independent oversight of FDA and the labeling. We examine all the serious adverse drug events that get reported to the FDA in any given calendar quarter, and sometimes we do annual reports. The other thing I do is I write scientific studies for the peer-reviewed literature about drug regulation and how to make drugs safer and how to find out more about drug risks.
I'm so glad I let you introduce yourself today. Do you have more about that?
A few more things, yes.
Please.
A few more things. Let's segue. I also have been interested for years in psychiatric drugs, and I'll actually tell you the story of how I got interested in it. I got a letter from a hospice nurse in San Diego, where I'm actually flying tomorrow, and she had been taking an antidepressant drug called Elavil, and not actually for depression. Her doctor suggested it might potentiate pain meds, and so she had been taking it. She had a back problem. But it got better, so she stopped. Well, 3 or 4 days after stopping, she had an episode of acute mania. She became psychotic. She was propositioning men in a bar. I think she jumped off the Santa Monica Pier and ended up in a psychiatric ward where she was given a neuroleptic or antipsychotic drug because of her psychosis. But unfortunately, this usually happens after long-term exposure, but after even relatively short-term exposure, she started to have tardive dyskinesia. And in fact, her hand, when she wrote me, I can still remember the crimped letters, because she had a bad tremor in her hand and was afraid she was going to lose her job as a hospice nurse because she couldn't write clearly anymore. So that was sort of my introduction to the fact that psychiatric drugs can help people under some circumstances, but also they have serious side effects that can be underrated.
Tom, how do you get funding for such a significant institute without turning to the drug companies?
With great difficulty, with great difficulty, because we are supported. ISMP has a variety of revenues. Its newsletters are bring in income. We get some grants and contributions from nonprofits. The Quarter Watch has a very seasoned team of experts. We have two former branch chiefs of the National Institute of Health. We have a MacArthur Genius Fellow. So we have, I think between us, we may not have published as many books as you, Peter, but I think 17 books. And we have experts on cardiovascular drugs. And all of us, I will say, are older, and we volunteer a lot of the time that's needed because we think this is a public service worth doing. There are not many people out there trying very carefully and scientifically to measure the problems we have in drugs and to help us figure out how to use them more safely.
Now, you write really good scientific papers, and I thought we might discuss two of them, but I also want to open it up for you to discuss more than that. One is just an invaluable paper where you look at, along with my friend Glenn Mullen and another author or two, you look at reports to the FDA of violence from different drugs. Another is about children and adverse drug effects. Maybe we could start with the study of violence because people are increasingly concerned about that. You know, we had the recent Lopez shooting at the fort down in Texas at Fort Hood, and he'd been started on an he'd been seen by a psychiatrist 1 month earlier, and undoubtedly, as happens when you're in the Army and you see a psychiatrist, I mean, I'm virtually certain he got an increase in his meds, and he was known to be taking, reported by the government, to be taking an antidepressant and Ambien. So this stuff is of great interest, and maybe you could take off from that on that marvelous paper that you produced.
Well, first, it's a tough topic. It's a tough topic because the cases that we have, we often only have fragmentary information about it. We can't be as sure as we'd like that the drug was responsible. It's a topic that our legal system does a very poor job with, because our legal system says if you commit a violent act, you're responsible for your actions. Our legal system says even if you maybe get drunk and commit a violent act you never would have if you'd been sober, you're still legally responsible because you could reasonably expect that you would know that you might lose control if you drank. Now, whether we can argue about whether this is reasonable another day, but that's how the system works. More complicated is when we get to cases that we call involuntary intoxication, which means that you didn't realize that the drug was actually making you into another person. And that's what happens in some of the most severe drug cases that I have been involved with. These are individuals with no previous psychiatric history. These are individuals who have no necessarily any previous behavioral issues or problems. And suddenly they are transformed. Sometimes they explode with rage, sometimes uncontrollable. Sometimes it's senseless. The drug that got me deepest into this issue is a smoking cessation drug called Chantix. And it was approved in 2008. And all of a sudden, we were getting reports off the charts about people becoming violent, people becoming psychotic, people becoming deeply depressed, or people sort of in a sort of undiscriminating rage that might turn on themselves or others. So the reason I wrote this paper that you're talking about, Prescription Drugs Associated with Reports of Violence, I told you my specialty is adverse events. So I sort of said, well, look, Let's conduct as objective a study as we possibly can. Let us give essentially every drug a chance to be included in this. Let's look through tens and thousands of adverse event reports. And we'll take any suspect drug. We'll take all comers. And we'll also assume, because we're scientists and we want to be objective, that there are going to be some chance associations. You know, somebody thought it was a drug, but, you know, they're wrong. So that's the study that we did. As I say, my interest was provoked by Chantix. And
well,
so
Tom,
let me
just clarify for folks. Tom is talking about reports to the FDA, to the MedWatch system, and evaluating those. That's the event reports he's talking about.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I can give you a little background, and your listeners should know that they can report adverse events. One of the ways we learn about the properties of drugs that are not good is because either patients or their doctors or caregivers either call the drug company or file a report. You can go right to the FDA, and you can report a drug reaction. And these reports are carefully collected and analyzed, reasonably carefully, and form a major body of knowledge. So if you or somebody you care for experiences a drug adverse event, it's really a good idea. It makes the system work better if you report it. Now, the bad news, by the way, Peter, is that only a small fraction of adverse events actually end up getting reported. It's a voluntary system. Nobody has to. So those are the reports. They're called MedWatch. You can go right to the FDA or Google up MedWatch, and you'll see how to do it. And there are more than 100,000 of these reports submitted every year, and that was what I analyzed. And so people didn't really like to think about violence as an adverse effect, so we picked very conservative terms. We looked for reports that talked about homicide. We looked at, for reports that talked about homicidal ideation, which means thinking, all of a sudden thinking you're going to murder somebody, and something that was outright assault, and another term that was a little vaguer called violence-related symptoms. And so when we did this study, we found 31 drugs had a clear signal for an association with violence. And some of them are sort of what, well, the first one was actually Chantix. Chantix in this system and data was worse than anything else we have. But antidepressants were also prominent. A drug called Ambien was very prominent. There's actually a lot of reports associated with Singulair, an asthma medication, actually. That's what we did. And it's the first, one of the first systematic study that tries to say, can drugs actually cause people to be violent?
One of the, I think, most brilliant things that you point out is that a lot of drugs have no reports. And I think a very few, one or two. I mean, they're just not in the ballgame. The second thing, and I don't remember if you made this point in your article that's so startling, is that since the leading drug, right just ahead of antidepressants, as I recall, is a smoking cessation drug, which means it's not, quote, the mental disturbances of the people using the drug, or the leading drug wouldn't be one that's given to such a broad range of people, that is, people who are stopping smoking.
Well, and it's not the only one. There is a malaria drug called Larium. That's certainly not necessarily given to people with an underlying psychological disorder. And even Ambien, a sleep aid, I'm not so sure, but you raise another good issue, which is one of the things that's confused this is that very often these drugs are given to a people with a mental illness. And so even if it's the drug that's responsible, it's hard to tease out whether it was the drug or the underlying illness.
Yeah, not to overdo the word mental illness on our show, because
okay.
Obviously, don't see these things as illnesses, but as human conditions. Yes, and you mentioned Singulair, which certainly is given across the board to a variety of people. So I think this is very, very cogent, your study. And any more thoughts about an Ambien, which was given to the shooter at Fort Hood? And, of course, people taking Ambien go across the population because it's used as a sleeping aid, not a treatment for serious psychiatric conditions. The evidence seems pretty clear and really confirmed by your study. It's certainly one of the most valuable there is. And I gather you do some court testimony on this. You and I have never done anything together in that regard. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I have. I have testified. I testified in a murder case. And in this case, and it was a great tragedy, a young private was a kind of Eagle Scout, and he enlisted in the United States Army, and he was an honor graduate from his basic and infantry training and went on to airborne school. He was a gung-ho Army guy, and he was the distinguished co-chair of the distinguished graduate honors for Airborne School at Fort Benning, Georgia, a place I was myself once. And so he is so promising that he is assigned to a prep school. He had only a GED diploma. He was assigned to a prep school, which if he completed it successfully, he would get an appointment to the U.S. Military Academy. So he was sitting in a kind of holding company in Fort Benning, and he went across the company. He was taking Chantix. It started about 10 days earlier. And he went across the street to do his laundry, and suddenly pulled a boot knife out of his boot, walked into barracks, and stabbed to death a guy he'd never seen before 51 times and killed him.
Wow. Were you able to help at all? It's very hard to help in these cases, folks.
I believe that our legal system is very poorly equipped. As you probably have done on your show, I guess we won't use mental illness anymore here, but our legal system is extremely poorly equipped to deal with problems that spring, I'm still going to say it, from some sort of mental disorder. I thought I read something in the paper that there were more people with potential treatable mental disorders in prison than there were in institutions. So our system, because it holds people accountable, and our system, it's just the way laws are structured, is not very kind. And, of course, you were mentioning some cases, and I'd have to say, I won't say I'm a dissenter, but I would have to say I would look very carefully at any of those other violence cases and say, were drugs responsible? Well, I'd have to say maybe yes or maybe no, but it would certainly take a complete evaluation of what the type I know you've done. It would take a complete evaluation, so I would have to call them possible, but the problem we have is that they are seldom evaluated. So how much of this is going on, we have no idea.
Yeah, I think that's very, very true. And, of course, I've been involved in many of these cases, and sometimes I'm able to be a significant help, sometimes a very big help. In one case, I was involved in the police officer who had been assaulted by the client, read my report and decided not to put his weight against the accused man, which was just most remarkable that he was able to be that empathic and responsible. And but often we're not able to get anywhere, especially in horrendous violent crimes, because people understandably just have trouble believing that that can be caused by drugs. But your kind of statistical analysis is just so, so important in demonstrating that there is a clear-cut scientific association, an epidemiological, I think it's fair to say it's an epidemiological study, isn't it?
Well, it is. But I did another type of study that helps sort of shine a little light into this dark corner, which is once again taking Chantix cases of violence. I selected 26 Chantix cases, and there I was able to do more of an in-depth analysis. And so we asked, what does a drug associated, in this case Chantix associated, what does an event look like? I mean, does it look like some of these terrible domestic cases that, you know, where, I don't know, a man and his wife who aren't getting along, and somebody gets drunk one night and seriously harms a person? Do they sort of look like those? What does the event look like? What kind of characteristics does it have? So a psychiatrist, Dr. Glenn Mullen, and I went through 26 of these cases. And we found some characteristics. And it was really funny because after we'd gotten through about 10 of them, we could almost tell immediately what the next one was going to look like, even though we hadn't evaluated, because they have some really distinctive features, at least in the case of Chantix. So what do one of these cases look like? Well, the first thing we found was certain people seem to get in trouble with these drugs almost from the first dose. And Peter, you may have seen some of that in benzodiazepine cases. I don't know if you've ever.
Oh, wait,
almost
actually,
from
Yeah, absolutely. Tom, I did an analysis of Paxil for a product liability case when inside the company reevaluated their data, and most of the very severe reactions, a very large proportion of them, occur in the first 3 days of the drug. And it makes sense if you think about the first time you have a cigarette, the first time you have a drink. You know, your body's unaccustomed and you get slammed.
Well, I have a slightly different interpretation, but I don't know that I'm right. My interpretation really is that maybe it's a difference in genetic makeup or predisposition, but these drugs just affect these people much differently than the rest of us. So, and it, in the case of Chantix, they're even started at a quarter of the normal dose. So these people were starting to get in trouble with this drug before it takes like 2 weeks to get up to the full dose, before they even got to taking a full dose. This drug was just not for them. It was triggering a very atypical. The second, there were some other really interesting characteristics. The second thing is the cases we did were just senseless violence. And we do read some ones in the papers that are senseless where I think we don't know about the drug. But in these cases, so a woman woke up in bed and attacked her boyfriend because he looked so peaceful. Another woman got angry, held a shotgun on her 80-year-old mother, and then locked herself in the bathroom and took an overdose of medication. Another person went to the bowling alley and just walked over and attacked a guy he'd never seen before in his life. The guy had two friends and knocked his front teeth out, and he spent the next month afraid to leave home for fear he'd attack somebody he didn't understand what was happening. So senseless acts of violence that sort of affected people, that was characteristic too. The other thing that was very unusual is we have tragically a lot of suicides, but we don't have very many suicide and attacks on others. You read about them in the paper, but if you look up the numbers, order of 1% of these cases involve harm to someone else as well as self of suicides. But in our data, about 45% of the cases, actually it turned out to be the self that got harmed, not the others. And of course, we see this and that kind of characteristic in some of these cases. We don't know that a drug involved, but the person does turn a gun or whatever it is on themselves at the end of this as well. A few other cases in ours, which is the people we studied just didn't have any violent history. I mean, these were middle-aged women taking a stop-smoking drug, and they're just not the kind of people that you would normally expect. And in almost most of our cases, they basically hadn't been taking any other psychiatric medication. And the other kind of key feature, and I don't know if you've seen this in your cases, Peter, but the first signs of things going bad were sleep disorders and disruptions. Is that something you've seen too?
Yes, definitely, but very often. But let me say there's no contradiction between your genetic theory and why it occurs so quickly, was what I was trying to respond to. I think it recurs so quickly because the brain is unaccustomed to the drug, and that, in fact, many adverse effects, especially central nervous system, occur with the first, second, or third dose of the drug. That was what I was trying to point out. And, of course, we have some studies out of Australia connecting the genetic inability to metabolize antidepressants so that they build up in the system, and that that's associated with antidepressant-induced violence. So, you know, I think that that your theory and the explanation I'm giving, they just tie together. I don't think they're in any way contradictory. We're going to be going to break, and when we come back, my brilliant friend Tom Ward does great research, sometimes with other folks I'm proud to call friend. We'll be back in a few minutes, and we can begin the music. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, and of course it's the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. My guest is Thomas Moore, who is an extraordinary extraordinary researcher doing some of the more important work that's going on out there. Tom, before we move over to the children's issues or whatever else you'd like to talk about, do you know offhand what percentage of the people on the smoking aid drug, Chantix, that committed violence were on no other psychoactive substance other than perhaps cigarettes?
Well, there are two parts to it, which is I studied a group of very specific cases where very few of them were. The FDA surveyed that, and they thought about 40% of the people reporting psychiatric side effects were also taking an antidepressant or other psychoactive medication.
So I think there's interactions a lot of the time. That's one of the things we see in the legal cases, is you've got one or two drugs that can cause violence, and they compound each other, often a benzo along with an antidepressant, for example, or a sleeping pill like Ambien along with an antidepressant, which is the case in the shooter, the most recent Fort Hood shooter. But what Tom's research so clearly dissects out is that you can have a drug like Chantix by itself with no other drugs involved, and presumably not a big loading toward disturbed people using it, and it's associated with reports of violence. And one of the things that Tom just didn't get to mention, I don't think, is that this data that he did is evaluated per prescription. So it's not skewed by the fact that, say, an antidepressant is being given to a lot more people. Where would you like to go now, sir, with your marvelous
research?
I
would just finish off your interacting. The question about multiple drugs, one of the, what you call it, dark corners of our medical world is that we do have some drug testing. And I would have to say for psychiatric drugs, it's not great, but it is substantial. But almost always it's done in very simplified form with almost no other drugs done. When you get to real psychiatric practice, what really happens is psychiatrists, and I'm sure you know this more about this than I do, mix up these cocktails that no one has any idea how they interact or what they're doing. And I see and hear about, you know, cases in kids where they're on four or five drugs.
Tom, on Monday, just yesterday, I was in day before yesterday, I was in deposition all day long on a shock treatment case where a man was on seven psychoactive substances, and because he wasn't doing well on them, his psychiatrist referred him for ECT. Nobody can do well on seven psychoactive substances. It's just not possible.
And other traps. I did some research on the antipsychotic Risperdal, and I was actually in a meeting. I worked for the, it led to a very large award. I was working for the Attorney General of Texas, and I was on my way home, and a young woman who I could sort of see was a medical student from the textbooks on her, you know, chair, was studying, but every 12 seconds, it would be like she was raising her hand in class, and you would know that medically as a choreoathetoid movement. And so I asked her, and she was obviously a medical student, and it was a very odd thing, obviously, on an airplane in the middle of a long flight. So her story was this, which is she had been taking a ADHD drug, and one of the problems with ADHD drugs is they can cause tics and tremors. And so her doctor had decided that she needed Risperdal because Risperdal in its early stages, which is an antipsychotic and causes tardive dyskinesia at a high rate, initially suppresses some of the symptoms. And so she got that drug, and that drug left her with a lifelong choreoathetoid movement. A brilliant young woman, obviously in a good medical school. But every 5 or 6 seconds, her hand just automatically got raised like she was in class.
It is
so that's
so
the other part, from one
sad,
bad
yeah.
problem to the next.
Yeah, it's very, very, very sad. I often think of a little girl I saw who was about 7 years old, whose most marked symptom of tardive dyskinesia was that periodically her eyes would roll up into the back of her head, kind of like, you know, a caricature of the space person, you know, who comes to Earth and is breathing through their eyeballs. And I thought to myself, and I still think about, although I have no follow-up, what's it going to be like for her if that doesn't go away, and then she's trying to date some sweet young boy, and she's looking at him, and he's looking at her, and her eyes roll up. I mean, these are just tragic and sad circumstances. Well, they don't get reported like that in the scientific literature. They get reported as numbers.
But even the numbers are very alarming. In the, yes. my assignment looking at Risperdal, they did a trial in what are called first-break patients. In other words, saying one of the problems we have looking at antipsychotic drugs is everybody's been taking them for a long time, and it's really hard to tell what was new and what the old drug was responsible for. So this is one of the rare studies where no one had essentially been exposed to antipsychotic drugs. This was their first episode, and these were people who had schizophrenia, or at least preliminarily diagnosed therewith. And over a year's time, between 8 and 12% of them developed tardive dyskinesia. So the injury rate for these drugs are very substantial.
Tom, I'm not sure I've seen that. Would you email it to me?
I certainly will.
Yeah.
But let me find a more cheerful subject for you. Get slightly. So Quarter Watch, which is my publication, we publish a quarterly report on adverse events, and our last one, and you can get it free on the ismp.org website if you'd like to go there, look for Quarter Watch. So we looked at adverse drug events in children under 18. We thought that would be an interesting topic, and there isn't much published. And I said we have some good news in a way. And so the good news really is that, of course, children are really surprisingly healthy despite all the worry that all the parents have to go through. And so when I looked at the big overview, I found children under 18 were 24% of the population. They still go to the doctor. So about 19% of doctor's office visits, but drug therapy was really quite small, and then they accounted for only 7% of the dispense outpatient prescriptions. So we are not as profligate with our drug therapy in our children, and that's a good thing. And the second part is a very large portion of that was questionably, possibly for appropriate, but was short-term therapy with antibiotics and some other drugs that were being taken for a short time. So as a consequence of that, we get a lot fewer adverse drug events occur. We have so much less exposure that our children are really at smaller risk than some of our other populations. You were speaking of the elderly, one of our highest risk populations. So, but in our report, we that's the good news. We have good news and sort of bad news. And so in our report, we still wanted to know, what, you know, there are 1,000 drugs out there. What drugs should we be looking out for? And so we published a list, and just 15 drugs actually accounted for about 40% of all the adverse events. This is something we find in drug safety, which is very often a small number of drugs account for a large share of the trouble. So what were they? Anyway, so that we ended up with a top 15 list. And my colleague, Dr. Kurt Furberg, came up with sort of a striking observation that sort of made all this findings work together, which he said, the drugs that were causing problems were typically one that people were exposed to for a long time. The short-term exposure wasn't really causing a lot of trouble. The only exception to that actually is ibuprofen, which can cause a lot of hypersensitivity cases. So that was the first rule. If you're going to watch out for safety problems, it's going to be the long-term. The second big lesson that we got was the principal, and this is a little bit scary, the principal side effect that sort of dominated the list were psychiatric side effects. Of the top 15 drugs, the sort of predominant side effect were psychiatric side effects. Now, the drugs themselves, what are we talking about here? Well, we have the ADHD drugs, you know, drugs like Concerta and Ritalin, Vyneos and Strattera. The antipsychotic drugs, we've been talking about them, and given their ability to harm, my own view is that these drugs should be used very, very sparingly in this population. And so those were the big ones, and then we had a few others that were psychiatric side effects, but were not psychiatric drugs. So Accutane or Clarivis, suicidal ideation and depression, big cause. This drug does make acne go away, but it is really a high-risk drug. Montelukast, which is Singulair, the asthma drug. Also very prominent, mainly suicide and depression, but with some aggression cases. And so it wasn't necessarily that the drugs had psychiatric targets. The exception to that, and then there were some drugs that are really quite specialized. We have some groups of drugs that are used for Crohn's disease in children. And they accounted for a lot of a lot of problems. But once again, they're powerful drugs taken long term. And I have a safety thought for the listeners who are out there who have children sort of thinking about it. As most of these drugs with potential psychiatric side effects, if you find a child who is suddenly seeming to act out. In ways that are just not normal for that child, we have a solution. You should work with your doctor, but that's D-challenge. Most of these drugs, it's not life-saving if someone stops an ADHD drug and you might want to taper it. It's not, you know, to see if that's what's causing the effect. Same thing for Singulair for asthma. It has a very small effect. And so you should work with your physician and make sure that you understand what's going on. But it's a low-risk proposition to find out by stopping the drug and seeing if the problem goes away. Because if it does, and then if you start the drug and it goes again, then you have a certain suspect. That's called reach-out. So that's what we found out about drugs with kids. Beware of the ones you got, and use the most vigilance for the ones you need to take long-term. And beware for psychiatric side effects.
This is such great information. I'm just so glad that you're on the show again, Tom. Another good piece of news about children in regard, for example, to tardive dyskinesia is that while it's common in children, they do have more resilience. And I've seen kids recover from the outer manifestations of it more commonly than adults do. But nonetheless, you never know how it's changed the child and what kind of permanent injury is affecting the development of the child, but out of sight. And that's a huge concern, is that these drugs are being given to children while their brains are developing. You get a developmental neurotoxicity as these drugs change the interactions of multiple neurotransmitters in the brain during the growth period. I've got a new article out, Tom, in the International Journal of Children and Society, in which I finally publicly and in writing call for a ban on giving psychoactive substances to children. We don't give them alcohol. We don't give them cigarettes. We don't give them marijuana, hopefully. I'm not expecting you to comment on this, by the way, but the article is now up on my website on Bregan.com, and I'm just saying to other professionals in this article and reformers that while we certainly are a long way away from achieving anything like that, it's time to start considering a long-range goal that children simply shouldn't be given psychoactive substances for the control of their minds or behavior. It just doesn't make sense. Children need love and discipline and education. They need it done wisely, and they need it done from a whole group of folks as the child grows up. And they don't need their brains and behavior controlled by drugs. But again, Tom, I'm not expecting to put you on the spot with that. You do such great research. Is there more you can tell us about your interests and where you're going?
Well, I'm looking at various types of drugs. At Quarter Watch, we're really worried about a group of drugs called anticoagulants, and these are drugs like warfarin, and there's a new one called Xarelto and another one called Pradaxa. And we are really concerned. These drugs are in a way like antipsychotic drugs, which is they have unusually high injury rates. If you take an anticoagulant drug for a year, and this is more in the older people, you have about a 15% chance of a bleed. And we have been pursuing research and publishing some papers and trying to get others published.
Tom, you mean a bleed into the brain, I think, right?
They could be. They're all actually, they not necessarily.
Okay.
They could be intracranial bleeding. Actually, with Pradaxa, it's GI bleeds.
Okay.
But something's really gone wrong here with anticoagulant drugs, and it's a little bit what's wrong with the drug industry, which is we've got these new agents, and instead of trying to make them safer, they decided that they wanted to make them easier to use. And so we have, in some cases, older patients who are getting way too much drug and are at unusual risk of bleeding. We have, in order to be easier to use, it means no blood tests, so we can't spot the people who are at high risk. So this is a high-risk treatment, and people who are taking these drugs need to be very vigilant. And unfortunately, neither the drug manufacturers nor the FDA have done what they need to do so we can make these treatments help prevent strokes and things, blood clots in your lungs that can be life-threatening, so we can get the benefits of these drugs without such a terribly high risk. So that's one thing I'm worrying about. I'm sure you talk about antidepressants and withdrawal symptoms.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've written a whole book called Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, A Guide for Prescribers, Therapists, Patients, and Their Families. That's my latest book, Tom, so it does deal with withdrawal.
We're certainly seeing a lot of withdrawal signals for drug withdrawal for duloxetine, which is, I'm blanking on the name of the trade name for it. Is Cymbalta?
The Eli Lilly drug, Cymbalta. They managed to do the best poisons of all. Eli Lilly is amazing.
So we're seeing a lot of signals for that, and sort of shocked by the incidence that the number, if you take women between the ages of about 50 and 59, something like 20% of the women are on an antidepressant drug, and a large fraction of them for more than 2 years. And the more than 2 years tells me that people are having trouble getting off the drugs.
Yeah, that's certainly my experience in my practice. As hard as I try, actually, some of these women, it's usually women, cannot get off the drugs. They really need inpatient, and I'm working facilities, and I'm working with a couple of organizations now trying to help drug rehab centers develop rehabilitation programs so people can come off of these drugs with inpatient, because what they go through is just too agonizing for them to do it as an outpatient. They get too frightened and too overwhelmed. It's really sad.
Well, the other problem...
Yep.
Can I add one more problem? The other problem is doctors underestimate how slowly you have to taper these drugs. I mean, your book does a tremendous job, and I've given out a good number of them. That these drugs have to be tapered unbelievably slowly.
Tom, before we finish, and we've only got about 4 minutes left, when I first met you decades ago, when we first had lunch in the seafood restaurant that doesn't exist anymore in Bethesda, Maryland, You were doing marvelous work on the drugs that were supposed to be helpful for cholesterol. And that's something that a lot of folks listening to this show may be taking, are these drugs that are supposed to reduce your cholesterol level. Could you, like, take 2 or 3 minutes and summarize the current research on that, including your own?
Well, yes. The world of cholesterol lowering since we met those many years ago has changed a lot because we have different type of drugs. But what we have now today is ever more, and we now have the set of drugs called the statins. The statins in the patients at high enough risk can be beneficial. But if you look at the new standards, practically the entire population over 60 or 65 could potentially be eligible for a statin, even though, and the second problem is your chance of benefit is very slow. The actual written guidelines, which people is that if you have a 7.5% chance of a benefit over 10 years, you should be taking a statin drug. Well, that's less than a 1%. That's like a 99-to-1 odds it'll do nothing for you and just put it at risk. And so I think those new standards are problematical.
Well, I'm sure they're created by drug company Flax. Now, that happens in every area.
Well, it also happens with physicians that aren't necessarily connected. They just get too enthusiastic about their own product.
Even without making a profit from it themselves?
Well, I think it can be both. I think it can be both.
I have no doubt that lobotomists, for example, remain very enthusiastic about what they do, and shock doctors. And, of course, the enthusiasm of physicians for any given treatment is not good evidence.
So can I ask you the last question? Which is you started with ECT. What do you you must have had colleagues. What do they think? Do they just turn off their critical facilities? Do they really believe they're helping people because they see some ostensible? They don't look as depressed. They may not look good. What do you think really goes on? How do you think they handle that emotionally? People who specialize in that.
I really don't have an answer, but I sure do think a lot about it. My most profound answer is that people don't want to look at the evil they do. And so when you get into high levels of evil, giving people electroshock and lobotomies, you just don't look. Another theory I have, which is, again, an unpleasant one, is that human beings are filled with violence toward each other, that we're both the most loving and the most violent creature on earth. Child abuse, for example, and international child sexual trade exemplify the kinds of evil we perpetrate. And I think that that violence drives a lot of these treatments, that it's a way to be violent but wear a suit. I think that a mistaken devotion to each other's colleagues, to your colleagues, keeps people from looking at it. I think that having one or two cases in mind where you once had a miraculous cure keeps you going through hundreds of cases. I think not following up patients, simply being in denial. Well, I haven't really unraveled a string like this in a while, Tom. I think there's a lot of reasons, and some of them are pretty ugly, why psychiatry persists. I think maintaining the medical model at all costs is another reason. The fact that when you do a lobotomy or consult as a psychiatrist on one, or when you give electroshock or refer for it, you feel like you're being a medical doc and you had so much training for that. So I think there's a lot of different reasons. I don't think any of them are laudatory. I don't think it's a simple matter of disagreement. Because I believe the evidence for the horrific damaging effects of those two treatments, for example, lobotomy and shock, are unquestionable. One of the things I noticed recently, Tom, is that I've been communicating a lot with a group of psychiatrists in Europe and about this, and I asked them to go to ectresources.org. And so far, they've all continued the debate without going to ectresources.org. Thomas Moore, thank you for being on the show. You're a a marvelous ethical man and a brilliant researcher, and it's informative to me to have you on the show. Thank you.
Well, Peter, it was a pleasure to be with you.
Bye-bye now, folks.